KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
It's going to be partly sunny tomorrow, the high reaching 60.
I have three daughters, and all of them want to get married, and all three of my daughters deserve to be able to get married.
Referendum 74 is not about equality. Gays and lesbians already have the same legal rights as married couples.
It's a relic, and I'm tired of saying that there are two sides to the Electoral College. There aren't.
The only side to the Electoral College Mo Rocca sees is the side that says, let's get rid of it. We're going to talk with Mo Rocca about his documentary a little later on Weekday. I'm Steve Scherr. Thank you for being here. We are going to start with Referendum 74, the same-sex marriage debate. The Washington State Legislature passed engrossed substitute Senate Bill 6239, allowing same-sex marriage, but enough signatures were gathered to petition the bill. Now the question is before voters. If Referendum 74 is approved, same-sex marriage will be legal in Washington State. Domestic partnership between seniors will be recognized as well. Arguments on both sides of the issue and some of your phone calls and questions this half hour on Weekday. Chip White is Communication Director for Preserve Marriage Washington. He is also a business and real estate attorney. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Eric Liu is an author and civic entrepreneur. His last book with Nick Hanauer, Gardens of Democracy. Good to see you again.
Good to be here.
Can I say happy birthday to you?
You can sing it.
Right. We'll sing it. We'll sing it a little later. All right, let me just start out with some basic questions. Why isn't same-sex marriage a civil rights issue?
Well, I'm happy to answer that question, but first I'd like to address a comment that was made just a minute ago, which is domestic partnerships for senior citizens will remain unchanged regardless of if 74 is approved or...
Right. Will remain recognized is how, yes, I should have said that.
Yes. So either way, the seniors keep their domestic partnerships and the benefits that go with those. You know, a same-sex marriage is not a civil rights issue because same-sex couples in Washington State already have all of the exact same legal rights and benefits as married couples. That's because 3 years ago, the voters approved the Everything But Marriage Law. That was Referendum 71 back in 2009. And the Everything But Marriage Domestic Partnerships Law is a very strong, very progressive law that gives registered same-sex couples all of the exact same legal rights and benefits that married couples have. So there are no new rights that gay and lesbian couples would receive if 74 is approved. Instead, people's rights would be taken away if 74 is approved.
Well, let me come back to that argument in a minute. Why is it a civil rights issue?
Well, Steve, let me just back up one step here and say, I mean, I'm here in the first place just as an ally of the gay and lesbian community. But more importantly, I'm here as an American. I'm here as a citizen of our country and our state. And to me, this is a question of equality under law. And for me, the question about marriage equality really boils down to a very simple, simple notion, which is everybody listening right now knows what marriage is. Marriage is an expression of commitment, special vows between you and your partner before family and friends. And it's one of the most important things that society recognizes as an institution. And when you think about marriage in these terms, to me, what Referendum 74 is doing is affirming the spirit of marriage. It's affirming the spirit that this institution matters for the people entering into it, for the children and the families involved. It strengthens families. And for me, one of the most basic things that we've got to recognize right now is that the question of, look, Referendum 74, I think, is going to pass. And I believe the day after it passes, we're going to be in a place immediately where we're going to be looking back and thinking, boy, wasn't it kind of amazing that there was a time when even in this state, this progressive state, we were unsure whether to include into this most basic aspect of society our gay and lesbian neighbors, friends, family members, coworkers, And to me, this is just a matter of citizenship and how we live together in a community.
Do you agree that the law as it currently stands provides all the rights and requirements to gay and lesbian couples that are given to straight couples?
You know, this is a common argument against Referendum 74 that, you know, the everything but marriage so-called law already provides all these rights. And I guess there's two things I'd say about that. In the first place, as a practical matter, you know, things, what you call things makes a big difference. And the fact that you have something called domestic partnership is not something that everybody understands or everybody knows what it means. And so when you have couples who are in domestic partnerships today, same-sex couples, and they're in a situation where, for instance, one of them is in the hospital and the other needs to be with that person under dire circumstances, it remains the case right now that not being able to call that person your spouse ends up being an obstacle, ends up being creating unnecessary confusion. And one of the things that I think has happened, you know, it's great that we have this everything but marriage law. It's better than what preceded it. But marriage is marriage.
Steve, you'll notice that.
Wait, I'm going to let him finish and then you can go. You'll have time. Are you done?
Well, look, I think one of the things that we've got to remember is that when you think about marriage, nobody, when two people are in love and decide they want to commit their lives together, one doesn't get down on bended knee and say, will you enter into a domestic partnership with me? One does not say, will you embrace this bundle of rights with me? Marriage is something more than just that bundle of rights. It is society recognizing a couple as a member of society. And that happens both on a day-to-day level, but also in emergency situations like the one I just described.
Steve, you'll notice that Eric does not deny that the everything but marriage law really does give registered domestic partners all the exact same legal rights and benefits that, that married couples have. But what redefining marriage would do, what this radical new definition of marriage would do, is it would change the shape of marriage for all of society. You see, there's a common myth somehow that same-sex marriage can coexist alongside of traditional marriage. But the real truth is that when marriage is redefined, it's going to be redefined for everyone in Washington state. And people who disagree, people who believe in the traditional definition as the union of one man and one woman, will find themselves at odds with the law. And the law.
Why will they find themselves at odds with the law?
Because the new law, if marriage is redefined, will be that marriage is a genderless institution. Terms like husband and wife are stripped out of the legislation that the legislature passed. And so instead of husband and wife, common sense terms that we've all grown up with, the legislation says spouse and spouse. And folks who believe that marriage is a relationship between a husband and a wife will find themselves on the wrong side of the law, and they will be treated as the legal equivalent of racists and bigots, and the strong arm of the law will be used against them. They will find themselves sued, dragged into court. This has already happened, Steve, in places where marriage has been redefined.
Where?
Yeah, in places like Vermont, where marriage has been redefined. There was a couple, Jim and Mary O'Reilly. They own an inn. They're innkeepers. And when they told a lesbian couple that they could not put their full hearts into supporting a same-sex wedding because of the O'Reillys' deeply held personal beliefs that marriage is the union of one man and one woman, they were sued. And they had to pay $30,000. And they had to agree never to host any wedding on their private property ever again. So it's not like Eric suggests. Eric suggests that there's no downside. Eric suggests that nobody is hurt when marriage is redefined. But you know who is really hurt, Steve? Is children. Children deserve a relationship with both their mother and their father, the two people responsible for bringing them into the world, their mom and their dad. Kids do best in a family that is headed by a married mom and dad. The male parent brings something special to the job of parenting, and the female parent brings something special to the job of parenting.
Let me ask you a question before you go on. And I am watching the time, so don't worry. Nobody's going to bulldog it. Why have state recognized marriage at all? Why have the state be involved in that at all?
There is one reason, and that is for the protection of children who need to have a relationship. Now, there are other reasons.
Well, why would everything but all law provide that same protection?
You're asking historically why has marriage been recognized? Marriage has been recognized because it is a special relationship. You know, the government does not regulate people's relationships with their friends. The government does not regulate my relationship with my best friend. The government does not regulate people's relationships with their boyfriends or girlfriends or lovers, but it does regulate marriage because marriage is a special, unique relationship that unites the two halves of humanity, the male half and the female half, and unites them along with any children who are a product of their union. And, you know, marriage is the one institution that we have as a society that helps to ensure that kids have a real meaningful relationship with both their mom and their dad. And a man, Steve, this is important, a man cannot be a mom and a woman cannot be a dad.
All right. Let me say that's Chip White, Communication Director for Preserve Our Marriage Washington. Eric Liu is an author, a civic entrepreneur. Let's back up to the question of whether men and women could be moms and dads. But let me start with that first point that Chip is making, that it strips out husband and wife, all those languages, all those words from the bill. I guess I have not read that in the bill.
Well, look, I don't think a lot of people, even hardcore KUOW listeners, are thinking that the language of the bill is what is at issue here. We are voting on Referendum 74, but what we're voting on is a bigger expression of, are we inclusive or not? And to me, what Chip is saying here about tradition and about the dangers of marriage equality, I think is really important to actually unpack, because Chip's painting a, you know, I know you're a lawyer, Chip, I think in the law, there's a phrase, parade of horribles, where lawyers like to trot out this kind of whole set of scenarios of awful, terrible things that will happen if you do X or Y. And what Chip is painting is just one step short of, you know, folks in black helicopters swooping down and telling
Eric, that's not fair.
Let him finish.
Telling folks that
I am watching the clock.
You are no longer a husband or wife. I think we need to have this conversation and have our listeners make this judgment, not on the basis of horribles that either aren't real or are exaggerated. I don't know that Vermont story, but I can tell you that a story about an innkeeper who wants to deny service to somebody because of their sexual orientation, it has nothing to do with same-sex marriage. That person is subject to anti-discrimination laws of that state or this state. But I will say, you know, in general here, this idea, you know, implicit in what Chip is saying is that there's just a fixed quantity of marriageness out there. Okay, and marriageness is defined as Chip wants to define it, and there's a fixed quantity. And by my goodness, if you let other people have a stake in this institution of marriage, you're going to dilute their other people's share of marriage. You're going to water it down. You're going to turn their marriage into something devalued. And I just, you know, that's just not true. When I think about my friends and family members who are gay and lesbian, and the relationships that they're in, their relationships, the existence of their relationships, let me say this, their existence as humans does not threaten me, does not threaten my existence, does not threaten the relationships that I'm in, does not undermine me. And I think the idea that, you know, the long arm of the law is somehow going to go out and water down or attack traditional marriage is not true. To me, this passing and supporting Referendum 74 is one of the most important ways we can reaffirm, not redefine. It's affirming the spirit of marriage, which is commitment and love and building a family.
That's Eric Liu and Chip White. I just do want to say, yes, the law does take away husband and wife and make spouse, though it also in this, I know you want to respond, but it also in this strikes down a clause that says the legislature finds that same-sex couples, because they cannot marry in this state, do not automatically have the same access that married couples have to certain rights and benefits, such as those associated with hospital visitation, health care, some other issues. So the legislature must have seen that there was a distinction between everything but marriage and everything but marriage law and marriage. But you wanted to respond overall.
Washingtonians are a generous people. Washingtonians are a kind and progressive people. And Washingtonians are a live and let live people. And that's the reason that voters are understanding, coming to understand, that same-sex couples have the right to live as they choose. Gays and lesbians are our friends and our neighbors. They have the right to live as they choose. But no one has the right to redefine marriage for all of society. And there are serious consequences when marriage is redefined. It's just not fair to say that there are no negative consequences. Legal experts, scholars on both sides of the marriage debate agree that redefining marriage will have profound impacts on society. And these will range from harms to religious liberties.
What religious liberties are harmed?
Okay. Well, not only harms to churches and religious organizations, but harms to individual people of faith. For example, in Massachusetts, where marriage was redefined to be a genderless institution and no longer to be comprised of a man and a woman, children as young as 6 and 7 years old in second grade public school were taught about homosexual marriage. They were taught in a book, King and King, that a prince can marry another prince. You know,
What's wrong with that?
6 and 7 years old. That is a tender age. That's an age when kids are just learning to recite the Pledge of Allegiance, just learning to tie their shoelaces and raise their hand before they answer the teacher's question.
So what's the impact?
The impact is that parents' rights, the rights of parents to direct the upbringing and the education of their own children, stripped away. You know, those parents asked for the right to advance notice when that was going to be taught in class. They asked for the right to opt out, to have an opt-out provision where their children would not be required to sit under that instruction about a man marrying a man at the age of 6. And you know what? Not every kid at the age of 6 is ready to learn about a man marrying a man. But those are the kind of serious negative consequences that occur in places where marriage is redefined.
All right, let me take a break, and then I'll come back. You can respond. We'll take a break for a minute. We'll also get some phone calls. Remember where we were. We're talking about Referendum 74 with Eric Liu and with Chip White. Eric Liu is an author and a civic entrepreneur. He's here talking about Referendum 74. Chip White is the communication director for Preserve Marriage Washington. This is Weekday.
Heavy rain falling in Seattle, 54 degrees right now in the University District. We're expecting a high today of 58. Forecast calls for clouds and showers all day. Tonight, cloudy skies with a chance of showers, the low in the upper 40s. It's going to be partly sunny tomorrow, the high reaching 60.
Support for KUOW comes from Northwest Center. Since 1965, Northwest Center has served people with developmental disabilities through inclusive childhood education, early intervention, employment services, and jobs. When people of all abilities work and learn together, everyone benefits. More at nwcenter.org.
It's 9:23. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle. News and information. I'm Andy Hurst. Humorist and writer Mo Rocca set out 4 years ago to find out how voting works in this country. His quest took him to Indiana, a swing state. The resulting documentary, Electoral Dysfunction, airs on PBS starting tomorrow. Mo Rocca joins us coming up in about 15 minutes.
Referendum 74 is on the ballot. You may have voted already, or you will be voting before Tuesday. Do not forget to get your ballots in the mail. It allows same-sex marriage. If it's approved, legislature passed it as Senate Bill 6239, but enough signatures were gathered to petition the bill. So you are now voting on yes for same-sex marriage legal in Washington state or no. Chip White is communications director for Preserve Marriage Washington, opposed to the bill. Eric Liu is an author and civic entrepreneur. All right, you wanted to, and I want to take your phone calls, which I'll get to in a minute after Eric responds to something.
Yeah, well, before the break, Chip was making a couple of arguments that I think just deserve a response. The first one was this idea that the passage of Referendum 74 and of marriage equality was going to undermine religious liberty. And I just want to note that the measure explicitly protects religious liberty. It explicitly protects the right of faith institutions to marry who they want to and to conduct their affairs according to their own religious beliefs, and that's an explicit baked in part of this measure, and it's something that's very important. The First Amendment of the United States Constitution already does guarantee that freedom of religion, but this measure takes an extra step to safeguard that. That's number one. Number two, back to the parade of horribles that Chip likes to trot out here of out-of-state examples. The idea that he's talking about of fifth and sixth graders being exposed to the idea that two men might marry. I guess I have two things to say to that. The first...
5 and 6 year olds. Weren't you saying 5 and 6 year olds?
5 and 6 year olds. Second grade.
Okay. So the first thing I guess I'd have to say to that is just a somewhat more technical matter about how things happen in this state. And, I'm glad that Chip acknowledges, as somebody who's visiting us from California, that Washington is a generous and open-hearted and progressive state. And we hope you'll come back and visit, Chip, after this measure passes. But one thing about this state and the way that education plays out here is this is a strong local control state. There are 294 school districts, each of which is making policy, in each of which parents and family members and communities have a say in how their kids are taught and what happens in their kids' schools. So number one, there isn't some great state bureaucracy that's going to come in here and teach things that that you at the local level don't know about. That's number one. But that actually is actually a technical point. The deeper point I have to make here is we have to ask ourselves, everybody listening right now and all of us in this state weighing whether to support this measure, we have to ask ourselves whether as humans we are indeed comfortable with people, two men or two women, in a relationship, and whether we are indeed comfortable with them having their relationship be known to 5 and 6 year olds. Because here's the thing. We live in that world already. We are in that world today. In my neighborhood, in my schools, in your churches, in every workplace, in this state, in this city and in this state, there are families today that have same-sex parents and kids. There are kids whose classmates in school have parents who are same-sex. And what this measure is about is saying, let us as a state, together, as a community, validate those relationships as marriage. Give those couples who have committed to each other, who in some cases are raising children already today, give them the chance that everybody else gets to try to build a life together, to be recognized not just under law, but in our hearts as fellow citizens.
You wanted to respond, and then I'm going to take some phone calls.
This is not just about relationships. People can have relationships with whomever they please. They can have close, intimate, emotional, personal relationships with anyone of their choosing. This is about the definition of marriage. And you know, Eric, not everything that is similar is the same. And that's why we do define marriage. And we have to be more careful than just to say that any two people who feel in love with each other can get married. Because already we understand that there are serious public policy issues at stake. People cannot marry someone who is underage. People cannot marry someone who is a close blood relative. And people cannot marry someone who is already married to another person, even if they feel deeply drawn, deeply attracted to that person. And there's a reason that we draw those lines. Not everything that is similar is the same. A same-sex domestic partnerships may have many similarities of true marriages, but a pencil may have similarities to a pen. But a pencil is not a pen. They're both writing instruments, but they are different. Only marriage is between a man and a woman. Only marriage unites the male half of humanity with the female half. and with children who are a product of their union. And, you know, Eric mentioned that there really wouldn't be a threat to religious liberties, but that's simply not true. The clause in Referendum 74 is a fig leaf. It's a political cover. It says that pastors and priests won't have to perform a marriage ceremony, a wedding ceremony, against their choosing. But, see, Eric let it slip. The First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution already protects pastors and priests in that situation. So the clause in R-74 doesn't give them any more protection. But we're talking about...
Is it reaffirming that protection?
No, it's really a distraction. It's a red herring. Because the First Amendment already protects them.
All right, let me hold you there. Let me get these two callers in. He's going to respond. Go ahead.
Well, we started this show with Chip, so I just want to make sure that we are going back and forth and not just back and not just backward.
I'm watching it.
I'm glad you brought up this idea of same and similar, Chip, because there is something to what you're saying that is very similar to the arguments. I'm not saying it's the same, Chip, but it's very similar to the kinds of arguments that were trotted out in our lifetimes just a couple of generations ago against interracial marriage.
That's offensive. Washington never...
Well, let him finish. Let him finish, then you can respond.
And let me say, too, I think it's striking that Chip is hair-trigger offended on a question like this, of a question of fact, an issue of fact, which is to say that it is a fact that arguments were trotted out against interracial marriage about this is not traditional, this is not natural, this is not in the interest of, my goodness, these mixed-race kids, that would be an abomination, not just against God, but against the order of society, and not everything that's similar is the same. And so it is a fact that these are similar arguments, the fact that Chip gets hair-trigger offended that way and not get offended by the fact that people who, again, are our fellow citizens in this state, well, you know, for those of us who live in this state, that cannot be included in the community, you know, I'm offended by that. I think that is deeply offensive. And look, this is not, I'm not trying to, I know we are going back and forth and it is a debate format, but to me, the point here isn't about winning a debate and scoring points. The point is just to ask ourselves, going back to what Chip said,
the
state is a progressive, open-minded, open-hearted state. And the question is, forget about the First Amendment. I want to go back to an earlier authority. Do you believe in the Golden Rule? Do you believe that others should be treated as you would like to be treated? Do you believe that if you have the right to marry, if you have the right to try to build a marriage, maybe not successfully, but everybody is trying to make that work, do you believe that others should have that right as well? It's sort of that simple.
Go ahead.
To say that the law,
same and similar.
To say that the laws are the same as the laws banning interracial marriage is offensive.
Why?
It's truly offensive to the 60% of African Americans who support traditional marriage. African Americans are amongst the strongest supporters of traditional marriage.
Well, what about the argument itself?
There is no meaningful distinction between races when it comes to marriage. There is a meaningful distinction between sexes. Here's the point. Laws against interracial marriage were wrong. They were about keeping the races separate so that one race could oppress another race. Laws about marriage diversity, about having one man and one woman in a marriage, are good because they are about joining the two halves of humanity and making sure that children are taken care of by their parents, the two people responsible for bringing them into the world, and making sure that women are not stuck with the overwhelming burden of rearing children by themselves.
Whoa, that was a leap. Even I would call that a leap. Why are you making that leap to women stuck with a burden of raising children by themselves?
My mom was a single mom, and she did the best she could under difficult circumstances. But it was difficult. It was not the ideal.
I know, but what does that have to do with two men or two women marrying?
The reason that we have marriage is to bind a man to a woman and to the children who are a product of their union. Kids deserve Kids deserve both a mom and a dad.
All right, let me hold you there. That was about the same. Let me get these two calls in, one on each side. Shauna's in Shoreline. Go ahead, Shauna.
Hi there. I just want to make two quick points. I know you have a lot to talk about, so I'll make this quick. But first of all, I'm a domestically partnered lesbian living here in the Puget Sound area. I'm pregnant with twins. We're due in a couple months. And I find part of what's really concerning to me about this debate to be sort of the dishonesty in the rhetoric for the folks who really want to protect marriage here, it doesn't feel authentic to me. I happen to be from the town in Vermont where the Wildflower Inn case took place. That's my hometown. I know that couple, and my family has frequented their restaurant and supported that business for decades. And the facts in this case are not accurate. The anti-discrimination statutes that have been on the books for a decade were the problem and what led to the lawsuit. And that's true, you know, that's a separate issue from marriage equality. But the other thing I find problematic about using a case like this poor innkeeper couple now has to not host weddings at their inn, et cetera, is that that's something in this particular case that they voluntarily chose to do so that they are not in conflict with the statute any further. It has nothing to do with a forced court decision or anything like that. They did not lose business because of that decision. It's something they chose to do so that they are not, again, not in conflict with the statute.
And all right, Shauna, let me hold you there because I want to get one more call in, and I'll let them both respond to wrap this up. I appreciate that call. And Jim's in Stillwater. Hi, Jim.
Hi. So I spend my life basically fighting discrimination. And the reason that I think it would be a travesty to legalize same-sex marriage in this state is that the same-sex partners will lose rights that they currently have. They will no longer, they'll be just like the traditional heterosexual people in this state, cannot assign a prenuptial agreement. It's been thrown out of court time and time again. Right now, same-sex couples can. They will lose that right. So, and they'll lose so many other rights. Just like I pay varying probably $100,000 over my lifetime more because I am a married person, and there's a marriage penalty, which is going to come back on January
1st. All right, let me hold you there. Let me hold you there on that, Jim, because I get your point, but that just begs the question of why I have state-sanctioned marriage at all in the first place. Chip, you got a minute here to respond, and I will hold you to that.
The reason that the government is involved in marriage in the first place is because marriage is special. Marriage is a special, unique relationship set apart from other human relationships. And it doesn't mean that people can't have relationships with whoever they want. Washingtonians understand that same-sex couples have the right to live as they please. But no one has the right to redefine marriage for all of society. Government protects the interest of children to have a real relationship with both their mother and their father. In fact, government has an obligation to promote the recognition of that right, to encourage men and women to marry before having children. Steve's noticing that I'm looking at some materials. These are materials that are available on the website, preservemarriagewashington.com. And I would encourage people who have questions, who are still undecided, to check out our website, preservemarriagewashington.com, and they will see resources that explain the serious legal negative consequences when marriage is redefined.
You get the last word because he had the first word.
Well, first of all, Steve, thanks for having this
conversation. And
you have a minute. And, you know, I want to say in the first place that I agree with Chip on one thing, which is that marriage is special. Marriage matters. Marriage means something more than domestic partnership. And marriage is something that has deep, deep roots. But even as it has deep, deep traditional historical roots, marriage is not a monolith. If you think about marriage and what it meant even 100 years ago, marriage was a relationship in which many women were more akin to chattel or subordinates than they were equal partners. And yet what happened? What happened was norms changed. Society evolved. And nothing in the law changed. Nothing in the law said, okay, women, you get to be, you know, treated more fairly and as partners in raising kids. And but what happened is that norms changed. And that's what happens right now, too. Norms are changing. We are in the midst of this. This is an, you know, and I want to speak to our listeners who are not sure about where they want to go on this, that this is about marriage mattering and opening and including access to marriage to every one of our neighbors, friends, family members, so that we can live truly as equal citizens.
All right. That's Eric Liu, author. His last book is Gardens of Democracy. Chip White, Communications Director for Preserve Marriage Washington. Polls are out looking at what is happening with this referendum. You can be sure to check out the websites for both sides. We have links at KOW.org. And don't forget to vote. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks.
Thank you. At one time in your life, six was mysterious, and six was an abstraction on par with something like truth and justice. That is, it's in the same Platonic realm that those lofty concepts are. And so, you know, that's a kind of interesting thing. Where do numbers live?
Stephen Strogatz talks about the links between mathematical concepts and pop culture. Hear more tonight at 8 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from AEG Live, presenting singer-songwriter Leonard Cohen on his Old Ideas World Tour. Leonard Cohen will be performing live at Key Arena on Friday, November 9th. Tickets are on sale now through Ticketmaster. More information at AEGLive.com.
Heavy rain in Seattle, 54 degrees right now in the U District. We're expecting a high today of 58, clouds and showers as well. Tonight, cloudy skies, chance of showers, the low in the upper 40s. It's going to be partly sunny tomorrow, the high reaching 60.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle University, offering a master's degree in criminal justice for individuals interested in law enforcement, victim services, policy, and more. Classes meet evenings and weekends. Details at Seattle University Criminal Justice Master's Degree.
Now to more politics. Mo Rocca's new documentary, Electoral Dysfunction. He's a correspondent on CBS Sunday Morning and host of Foodography and My Grandmother's Ravioli on the Cooking Channel. You also hear him on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. For this PBS documentary that's showing tomorrow on KCTS at 2 p.m., he traveled to Indiana, and he came away with a distinct distaste for the Electoral College.
It's a relic, and I'm tired of saying that there are two sides to the Electoral College. There aren't. And for the defenders who are listening right now who go, what about the small states? Well, number one, I'm sick of the small states. They don't need defending. Anybody I know from Wyoming could kick the butt of anyone I know from California. So the small states are doing just fine. But moreover, the Electoral College doesn't even favor the small states. Here's what the Electoral College does. And we're even setting aside its origins, which are very problematic. But it favors swing states. It favors, in this election, I guess, about nine states that just happen to be states where the candidates are close in the polls. So rather random when you think about it, that these states should get not only all the time from these candidates, but they also get favored legislatively. Historically, that's been shown that swing states end up exercising an unhealthy influence over, you know, a White House, a president's lawmaking agenda. So it's a bad thing, and we can talk about the origins if you want to. In order to get the 13 states to agree to the Constitution, voting became very, very tricky in how a president was to be selected. They decided very unenthusiastically at the end as a compromise to go with the Electoral College. And one of the reasons was because it was a way for the slave states, for the southern states, to get credit for their slaves. So South Carolina would otherwise treat slaves as zero-fifths of a person. But under the Electoral College system, they had more weight in choosing the president because each slave was counted as three-fifths of a person. So they basically got rewarded partial credit for their slaves when it came to choosing the president.
But why did the northern states agree to that?
Because there was no other way to get the southern states on board, and I think probably the southern states wanted full credit for their slaves, wanted each slave to be counted as a full person, which would have given them even more members in Congress and more weight in the Electoral College. And so the Electoral College, just like the Senate, by the way, is tainted by slavery. There were other reasons for the Electoral College which have outlasted themselves. Number one, there was a fear that people who could cast a vote wouldn't know the candidates very well. A farmer in Massachusetts might be too isolated to actually know who these candidates were. A reasonable concern back then, but these days, I mean, we're too connected. We can't be torn from our cell phones. And lastly, in more general terms, the idea of an indirect election, people going to the polls, voting for somebody to vote for them, which is what happens at the Electoral College, was not uncommon at the time. It was a way of punting also because the states could not agree on who would have the right to vote. So the Constitution largely sidestepped the issue of voting altogether. There is no right to vote in the Constitution. It's only implicit by way of those amendments that bar discrimination. But there is no actual affirmative right to vote in the Constitution, and for a good reason.
Yeah, no, we left it up to the states to decide so they could, you know, be happy with what they got to decide.
Yeah.
Mo Rocca is a correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning, panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, former correspondent at The Daily Show, and the creator and presenter of Electoral Dysfunction, a new documentary that's on PBS.
I've also got an awesome cooking show.
Yes, you do. Let's go over those. I was going to come back to the awesome cookingness and the other things, but if you want to tag it now, go ahead.
Yeah, it's called My Grandmother's Ravioli. It's every Wednesday on the Cooking Channel, and then they repeat it like 55 times during the week. And it's me learning how to cook from grandmothers and grandfathers across the country. It's heartwarming and hilarious.
Only your grandmother, right? You eat the same thing every week.
Not my grandma. My grandmother would be 147 now. But no, it's other people's. I feel guilty because I didn't learn how to cook from her, so I'm doing the next best thing. I'm learning how to cook from everybody else's grandparents.
All right, I'm circling back around to that. But I just have another question about this electoral dysfunction.
Yep.
I was watching some of the film. Why are those little kids dancing?
Well, to explain to the viewers and for some good analysis on the Electoral College, I went to a group of third graders, a classroom of third graders, and we held an election between colored pencils and magic markers. Markers won the popular vote, but colored pencils won the Electoral College vote, and there was a riot. I mean, one kid in particular just lost it. And, you know, look, third graders have an uncorrupted sense of fairness. I mean, they haven't yet been brainwashed. And so I think we should put all thorny issues like the Electoral College in front of third graders, and you'll get a good, clear answer.
You talked to a lot of people who were concerned about voter fraud and the battles over voter ID laws. Did you find any real voter fraud in your conversations?
You know, what I found is, you know, when I made this movie, it really was a journey for me. I know that sounds awfully, like, heady or new agey or something, but it was. I really knew very little about how voting in this country works. And like a lot of people, and in fact the majority of Americans, when I heard about voter ID laws, that you know, the idea that you should have to have a photo ID government issued when you go to the polls, I thought, well, that sounds reasonable. And I totally bought the line that, you know, you need a photo ID to get on an airplane or rent a movie from Blockbuster. Well, even setting aside the outdatedness of the Blockbuster reference, because really shouldn't we be going with Netflix at this point, once I listened a little bit more, I realized that these laws actually aren't good. And here's why. There are a number of people in this country that don't have government-issued photo IDs. They tend to be older people or students. They tend to be poorer. Many of them are people that have voted for decades. Many of them, the Indiana Voter Hall of Fame of people who have voted for over 50 years and never missed an election includes several of these people. In Indiana, I bring that up because that's the state where the first stringent voter ID law was passed, photo ID law. But the other reason why these laws are not good is because they're not necessary. The only law that a photo ID law, the only crime, excuse me, that a photo ID law addresses is in-person voter fraud, voter impersonation, showing up at a poll and saying that you're somebody that you're not, which sounds like something that would happen in an old Carol Burnett sketch, Tim Conway or Harvey Korman putting on a disguise. The most exhaustive study has shown that in the past 12 years in America, during which hundreds of millions of ballots have been cast, there have been 10 convictions for voter impersonation. Now, so basically, our electoral system has so many problems. Photo ID laws address the one problem that we don't have. Now, that's not to say that there's not fraud, because I don't want to be, you know, somebody who says, oh, no, there's no fraud at all. That's absurd. The system is very vulnerable when it comes to touchscreen voting. You know, I think we all probably know a 15-year-old who could hack into one of those things and throw an election, especially the ones that don't have paper trails, the touchscreen voting machines without paper trails, which exist in 11 states. Also, absentee balloting, which is more and more common, is prone to fraud. But it's not a good thing to make in-person voting even harder than it already is.
Mo Rocca has a new documentary out, Electoral Dysfunction, on PBS stations. Well, What is your biggest concern for this election in terms of this dysfunction?
My biggest concern is the provisional ballots, and that what will happen is, because of the voter ID laws especially, you have a situation where a lot of people will show up at polls and be told that they can't cast a real ballot, but they can cast a provisional ballot, and they need to take it to a courthouse in many cases to then get validated. And in close elections, I think this could end up creating a very unsettled, maybe even chaotic situation, where we have a lot of it's so razor thin, the margins with this, the polls at least right now, and it would be unfortunate if we're left waiting for days to figure out who actually won the election, because we're waiting for provisional ballots to be counted or challenged, thrown out, or accepted. There's just too much room for our worser angels to take over. I mean, elections bring out the worst in us, and it's not helped by having all these loosey-goosey rules and systems, by having this patchwork. If we all voted on the same ballot, if we all had the same polling hours, registration rules, if we all had automatic registration, there would be less room for manipulating the system.
Would you also like to see, what, popular vote electing the president?
Yeah, I would, because I think right now, look, you know, the gravitational pull of the political center means that every presidential election, I think, is going to be pretty close. Really, the only presidential elections that aren't close is when there's an ideologue. When you have, like, 1964, you have Barry Goldwater. You have somebody who, an ideologue who either loses by a vast amount or, in the case of Ronald Reagan, trounces the competition. Otherwise, when you have two pragmatists, and I think Obama and Romney are pragmatists, and it tends to move right to the center. Both guys move to the center, and you get a razor-thin margin. And, you know, if we had a popular vote right now, don't tell me that Mitt Romney wouldn't be in Orange County trolling for votes, and that Barack Obama wouldn't be in Austin trolling for votes, in Texas, in states that those guys never go to. And I also believe that they would both be running ads or making a stop in South Dakota, because, you know, the smaller states have populations that pretty much equal to the margin of victory in this election, the probable margin of victory. So let me say this. They'd certainly be going to more than 9 swing states.
That's Mo Rocca. The PBS documentary Electoral Dysfunction airs on KCTS 9 Friday, November 2nd at noon. Now the Art of Our City, where Seattle has a national reputation for its arts and culture scene. The public official in charge of overseeing this community is the director of the Mayor's Office of Arts and Cultural Affairs, the OACA.
OACA,
Marcy Soman is here to talk about that.
Yep, the job's been vacant since August, and late last month, Mayor McGinn appointed a beloved Seattle figure, Randy Engstrom, who's the founder of Youngstown Cultural Arts Center, to take over the job. He young, active, and I went to visit him in his office, and first question I asked is, what the heck is your job?
Well, I think ideally what this office should do is support and sustain and grow the arts and cultural resources for the city of Seattle. When people have asked me in the last couple of weeks what my job is, I say, on the one hand, it's to give away money. On the other hand, it's to explain why we're giving away money and make the case for that. And on the third, if you have three hands, on the third hand, it's to find more money. We're not a funder exclusively, and I think a lot of our work is about engaging with our community and making sure that we're having the highest and best impact that we can to grow sort of the vast cultural resources of the region. Money helps, and so, you know, we want to try to grow that resource as well.
Well, while we're on the topic of money, for the last few years, this is, I think things are going up for the city in terms of tax revenues, but for most of Mayor McGinn's tenure, money has been down, things have been frozen, departments across the board, including this office, have been cut. And I think a lot of people that I've talked to in the arts community were looking for someone in this job to be a standard bearer, I guess is the right word, to be the most visible advocate for the arts. Do you accept that role?
Well, I'd be honored to do it. I think my humility would preclude me from putting myself in that position, but I think that's true. I think whoever's heading this office should be the biggest champion and evangelist for the arts and culture community that we have. I think it's my job to tell the story and to be out as much as I can and to be advocating as much as I can.
I think every year, 4 years, 3 to 4 years, for as long as I can remember, Arts Fund, you know, they do that study. They talk about the economic impact in the city, and yet it always seems like it's a small group preaching to the choir. The people who read that study already agree that the arts are important. So how do you breach that divide, if you will?
Yeah, I think the work of our office should be, in large part, to get beyond the choir. That can look like having conversations with the chamber, with Rotary, with downtown business interests and folks that are driving local economy. It also means within the city's infrastructure, being on interdepartmental teams, whether that's about public safety or downtown revitalization or education or jobs. I think that arts and culture should be at the table for all those decisions, not because it's like a charitable act to let arts in the room, but because we can bring so much to bear to help those issues. I think that arts and culture is a strategy and a resource, not just something that we need to fund because it's nice to have.
When you talked to the mayor about this job, were there specific areas or specific things that you felt that he wanted done for you to do or whoever was in this position to do?
I think the mayor had a great interest in seeing the arts and culture office and community work better with other functions of government, other sectors within the city, which, you know, as an arts commissioner, I also was an advocate for. I think we have big problems to tackle in the city, and I think he wanted somebody who could represent arts and culture at the table to do those things, not to have arts and culture live as a silo, sort of in its own world. And I think he has a real strong commitment to social justice, and that's a focus of his administration. That's a lot of my background in the arts has come through that lens, and so I think we had a lot of alignment there. And I personally believe that the mayor's values and the arts community's values aren't very far apart. I think it's a matter of building that bridge and doing sort of the cultural translation piece and figuring out where we have alignment and how we can advance common cause that way.
Let's talk about funding programs for a second. You mentioned when I asked what your job was to give away money. There isn't all that much to give away. There is some, but how do you see the sort of way that business has been done, business as usual, arts funding, and potential ways that it could be done?
I think the staff does a great job here. I have a ton of respect for this office and for 4Culture and the work that they do supporting the sort of regional arts ecology. You're right, there probably isn't enough money. I don't think that the city of Seattle will ever be able to be a primary funder for the arts landscape. I do think there's a lot of other things we can do, whether it's technical assistance or advocacy or other ways of creating value and creating impact. I think that we need to have a much bigger conversation with the city of Seattle, everybody who feels connected in any way to arts and culture, about how we can best do our job as a department. That is a longer planning process. That's not something I'm going to come in and,
right,
you know, mandate in my first, whatever, 3 months. But I would like to figure out how we can create more resources and better support financially the Seattle landscape. I think that looks more like finding alignment with other sectors and less like standing alone and hoping that we can guard the resources that we have. I think we have to be part of a bigger conversation. And I think it also goes back to that getting beyond the choir. We have to demonstrate our value not just to the arts community, but to the whole community. And I think when we do that, we have more capacity and more opportunities to grow the funding that we do have. I think that it's a false choice to look at large institutions and small institutions or community arts and fine arts. I think our ecology is dependent on all of them being successful because they all feed each other. I think there have to be careers in the arts that people can aspire to, and I think we have to have a middle class and an entry level for people to climb that ladder and to get to that place. I think the biggest threat to our regional cultural ecology is a real lack of artistic middle class. And I'd love to help figure out what the office's role is in supporting that. The world is changing. I don't think that means we walk away from our large institutions. I think it means we have a conversation about what the right way to support all these different components is, and where it's hard to know if we're being successful if we haven't defined where we're trying to go. And so I think we need to do some of that goal setting, some of that collective visioning. And I want the ballet in the room, and I want Shunpike in the room, and I want arts education providers in the room. I want everybody to help us steer the ship where it needs to go. And then we can decide how best to do it and if we're being successful.
For the Art of Our City on weekday, Marcy Silman talked with Randy Engstrom, the new director of the Office of Arts and Cultural Affairs in Seattle. That sound of the day is Caitlin Gaylord and her grandfather, Franz Snyder, cleaning out their pumpkins to get them ready for carving last night for Halloween. Thanks to Lauren for sending in that sound of the day to mark this holiday. You send us a sound, won't you?
Stick around for NPR.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.